Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
And good morning. It is the Brown Briefly. And we're having a little bit of a technical issue here. And it may just be a couple of minutes before we can get the darn thing straightened out.
Shall I take over at the microphone here for a minute?
I think you can do that. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, Truman.
How are you this morning?
Good. I'm trying to get my mic on and see if this is recording. This is going through.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
can you hear it?
Yeah, we're getting you loud and clear.
Okay,
how about
good.
You?
No. Good. Well, I will welcome everybody while Truman is working on the Zoom connection for the rest of our brieflies and say good morning. I'm your host today for the Vachon Brieflies, Brown Brieflies, and we have a fun program. If we can get everybody on, we'll have our usual check-ins and local happenings and kind of humorous updates and crazy perspectives on the week from our team, if we can get them on. And we have a guest today, Sandra Noel, Vachon's Poet Laureate. And I'm pretty thrilled about having her here because one of the things we tend to do is beat our heads about the idea of logic all the time and why logic isn't really helping, you know, change minds and help get everybody vaccinated. Here we are at a place where the hospitals are full, death rates are raising because people haven't gotten vaccinated and they are in the hospitals dying at a higher rate than they ever have. So logic doesn't seem to work with people. And so one of the things I thought about is what is it about poetic language that is so simple and beautiful and truthful and deep and not challenging, you know, to people in the same way it challenged you deeper. So hold on, I'm going to switch chairs and get Sandra settled here, and then I will be back to kind of see where Truman is, and we'll either Sandra and I will do the show, or we'll be able to get Bruce and Kevin and Gail on and do the regular show. So hold on one sec. Here. Sandra, would you do a little voice check-in and say good morning?
Good morning, everybody.
Good. I could hear you fine. You know, it's been a wild week this week, I'll just say, in case we can get the rest of the team on. You know, we have new vaccine mandates and new vaccine availabilities. I'm personally going to go get my booster shot tomorrow at 4 o'clock. You know, the Haitians are being turned away from the southern border in cruel ways. Once again, it's like the Border Patrol has learned nothing. And the homeless plans are coming along. The debate in Seattle is coming along. And most interestingly to me, there's a doctor in Texas who has challenged the abortion restriction laws, and I am very interested in kind of how that's going to go. And we're going to take a little crack at thinking about the idea of logic versus kind of poetic language in looking at crisis issues and the depths of fear that people, you know, are holding on to inside. And the voice that you heard just a moment ago was not just me and Truman, but was the voice of our founder, Brian Brown. And he is not with us anymore, but he set the tone for us trying to model civil discourse and a little humor and kind of a group of friends trying to make sense out of the day and bring some integrity to our conversation where we're not being hostile with each other and cancel each other out, but we're really trying to listen for understanding, not to convince, but to understand where people are coming from. It's a whole new form of listening, you know, that's more dialogue than debate. And so I hope that you'll enjoy the show today with Sandra Noel coming. So let me just kind of move into introducing her a little bit because what I know about Sandra is that she's a freelance illustrator and graphic designer who has worked in environmental education a lot, doing a lot of promotion, you know, brochures and exhibits and signage for environmental issues. And she volunteers for Alliance for Tom Potika, which is a nonprofit conservation organization working in Indonesia. And she is our new poet laureate for 2021 through 23. I'm thrilled to have her here. Her poems have been in the Buddhist Poetry Review, Aloha, Gadugi Journal, and other journals. Chapbooks include The Gypsy in My Kitchen, which I love, Into the Green by Finishing Line Press, both of those, and then The River with Kelsey Press, and Unraveling the Endless Knot by Middle Creek Publishing. And she's just released a full-length poetry book, Love Island, published by Goldfish Press. She can be reached at noeldesign@centurytel.net. And so, Sandra, I'm so glad to have you here. And I guess what we're going to do at this point is just go on as if the team might come in, but they might not.
No, it's fine with me. I'm seeing how the sausage is made, I think.
It's unpleasant, I'll tell you. There's lots of stuff on the floor, I'll tell you. A metaphorical floor. But, you know, Sandra, I wanted to have you here to kind of think about the idea of poetic language and what it is that brings people to a different place, what brings people to poetry, you know, and we'll talk today about kind of how thinking slower, you know, kind of not thinking so fast and so frantically about everything can bring us some benefits and maybe listen to some poems as well. So it looks like Truman's still working on the Zoom connection for our team. And so if you're out there listening, team, be patient. I don't know what's going to happen. I'll get Truman to maybe email you or text you one more time, but we're going to go ahead. Anyway, Sandra, welcome. And I'd really love to hear you kind of talk about your work in general and kind of, you know, what brought you to poetry and what about poetry works so deeply.
It's a big question. For my part, poetry's kind of always been a haven for me, both reading it and writing it. And I want to also mention, I have Love Island out, which is at the little bookstore, but there's another book there that just came out by Ann Spires. It's called Backcut. I just got my copy from the Vashon Bookshop, and Ann Spires is one of the best poets writing today, and this book, as far as I'm concerned, is just a masterpiece.
Well,
please go get it.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
We know her well, and I'm really cheered to have you support her in that way.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
And for the, as poet laureate, which I'm really feel honored to have been chosen for that, considering the level of poets we have on this island. What we're trying to do during the pandemic is get poets' voices out there. And one way we're doing that is through the Voice of Vashon. Soon we're going to be doing a program where poets will read online through a pre-recorded setup, and later we'll have it available for people to listen to. That's in the works currently. It looks like maybe October 3rd, but I need to get back to everybody on that. And the other is one of our poets is working on putting together a Zoom poetry reading. We used to have these readings at the Vashon Bookshop and other places, but because of COVID, obviously we can't. So we're working on that.
Well, that sounds really fun.
As to the other part about poetry, right now, things are pretty chaotic out there, as we all know, with the pandemic and some really draconian laws as far as women are concerned.
Exactly.
And so not all poetry can be really healing and calming. It can be, but in these times like today, I think poetry needs to speak out and speak up. And I brought a little book that was written by a great poet named Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty.
Yeah, he's my man.
And he just passed away, actually, last year at 101 years old. But he wrote a little book back in 1975. It's called Poetry as Insurgent Art. I'm just going to read a little bit of this because I think it's very much contemporary for today. I am signaling you through the flames. The North Pole is not where it used to be. Manifest destiny is no longer manifest. Civilization self-destructs. Nemesis is knocking at the door. What are poets for in such an age? What is the use of poetry? The state of the world calls out for poetry to save it. If you would be a poet, create works capable of answering the challenge of apocalypse, even if this means sounding apocalyptic.
You know, I was really entranced by both Allen Ginsberg and Lawrence Ferlinghetti because I came up in the 70s.
So did I.
And it was a time much like now in which everything was crazy, and it felt like it was a tipping point and a turning point, and everybody was in the streets. And yes. Allen Ginsberg and Howl came out about that same time. And when I started writing poetry, it was in that vein. And some of you who have heard me read around here recently know that I am working on a little collection called Rude Poetry for Rude Times. And it's exactly out of that line of thinking, that things aren't pretty always, and we shouldn't try to pretty things up that aren't pretty. We need to get to the root of things. Hold on, I'm getting a message from my team, and three people talking to me at once, so hang on just one second.
Sure.
How do you moderate then, Sandra, your tone between the beautiful, the poetic, the kind of stillness that resides in poetry with that understanding that things can't all be pretty?
Well, I think personally speaking, as a poet, mostly I write nature poetry. That is almost right. the subject of anything I've written, because in nature, that is where I find peace and am able to think clearly. This island is perfect for that. And I've written some poetry regarding what's happening now with the climate and how devastating that is, but also how beautiful the world still is and why it's important to take care of it. So I really feel continuing to be a voice for the planet in that regard is important.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot about the children who are suing the state based on the idea that nature should have a voice, and talking about, you know, why do we not have laws that give voice to the broader environment and our earth. You know, I'm just touched by that. Another piece that I kind of want to mention right here is I know that the organization called 100,000 Poets for Peace, which I'm going to be reading with through the Florida State University program that is putting on, you know, one of the worldwide conversations, you know, through poetry, mm-hmm. about working for change. They also believe that we're not teaching children enough about poetry, or more importantly, poetic language and reflection, and kind of, you know, being still and thinking deeply about what's happening. And they have a lovely website, which I'll give y'all a little bit later. It's basically easily found at 100,000poets.org. But I'm pairing this, and I want to ask you a question based on it in just a minute, that I was getting ready to do this, which is Saturday, kind of all day Saturday, the 25th. And I happened to run across an article on, I guess it's a performance piece on NPR in the morning yesterday, from a study at the University of Bath in England, in which the students have been reporting their feelings about climate and climate disaster. There were 10,000 children, youth actually, 16 to 25 youth across the world that were asked very specific questions about how they're feeling about their future. And they are so depressed that their language there is very raw. You know, they're saying they feel abandoned. They feel betrayed by adults. They feel like the leaders don't care about them. They feel like their future is doomed. And here we have children, you know, Greta Thunberg going to the United Nations saying, what is wrong with you? You know, why are we not addressing this kind of thing? And adults aren't listening. And I don't know kind of how more powerful a language, you know, we can use in our appeal to people who don't seem to care about much more than money and, you know, maintaining the status quo because it profits people. And, you know, we're at a point of big turning. The world is going to have a great reckoning very shortly. We're part of it now. And I guess one of the things I want to ask you is what do you think about, you know, how we can work with children about these issues of climate? You know, have you had experience working with kids writing poetry or kind of trying to learn how to express themselves in this form?
No. I've worked with children with art in that regard, but not with poetry. But I really feel this time frame, we have been like the froggy in the pot. You know, you put the froggy in the pot before the water starts to boil, and over time, before you know it, you got a boiled frog. And we're not quite to that level yet, but I think for young people, there has been enough information out there, and I think this has caused, on one level, the reality is, yes, the seas are warming, the climate is changing, it's been going on for a very, very long time, and things are going to get a lot worse because we have not dealt with this problem as we should have as a global entity. But also, there's a bit of a problem with hysteria in the sense that young people also need to be helped and taught that there is hope with activism and with eventually with voting, and that there are paths to a better world. We can't just throw up our hands and say, oh my God, this is it. It's it if we don't try. It's it if we don't vote. It's it if we don't get involved. Apathy, in my book, is what's got us here. And of course, corporations and that drive for money, but apathy.
Yeah.
Apathy.
You know, I think that's a very challenging word because, you know, I'm a social worker by training, and I know that when people are terrified, there's a paralysis, you know, the fight and flight response or the freeze response, where I think some of what's happening is out of a sense of not knowing what they can do. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in a situation where our government controls less and less and the corporations control more and more, so it's harder to know who to advocate to through the government. It's harder to know how to address the corporations. And all we can do, I feel sometimes, is get in the streets and make our presence known and figure out how we can phrase things, I guess, in a personal way that gets deep under the rationalizations and the profit motive and all of that, that is sort of trying to appeal to our need to work together. You know, we're so polarized. We have got to work together on this. So
yeah.
I'm kind of wondering how you would approach those things. And I want to come back to this poem that you did about the Texas abortion laws, too.
Okay.
But first.
Well, how do we work together? There is a lot of polarization right now, and we even have people who are encouraging people not to be vaccinated during a pandemic. There are some, you know, there's always this thing about there's two sides to every argument. I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
I think in this case, we're polarized on a lot of levels, and it's going to be hard to find a center. What's interesting is this last presidential election, we had more people voting than ever before, ever, because
right.
people woke up after having the last person who was in office, they woke up and went, oh, my God, we can't have this. And people in some states in the South actually mobilized and managed to keep us in a slim majority in the Senate. Without them, I don't know where we'd be now. But that mobilization, to me, says, okay, we can do this. We just have to show up. Just show up.
That's exactly it. And it reminds me of Dr. Seuss. You know how they say everything the important we learn in kindergarten? And I think of Horton Hears a Who, you know, in that book where they're trying to tell children you can't be passive in the world. When things are dire, we stand together. And that's the only thing, you know, every voice needs to be heard. And I am so appalled. I'll switch gears for a second from the climate to the restricted abortion laws that are in Texas. Because, for example, I have been astounded all my life that there's such need to control people's bodies, women's bodies. I don't see anything equivalent on the male side of dealing with unwanted pregnancies. I don't see any interest in the opposition side there that helps deal with the care and the welfare of unwanted children when they are born into, you know, homes that don't have love for them. I don't understand how the separation of church and state is not being enforced, because these are personal beliefs, and people are absolutely entitled to their personal beliefs. You know, is kind of logically what I think. I don't mind that. They can do whatever they want, but I don't want other people's beliefs intruding on my medical action. Mm. That's important to me, and I don't see anything equivalent to that anywhere else in the law. And so for me, I've been kind of astounded that the Supreme Court has not acted, and I've been excited. What you're talking about is that people have to realize what they can do. Okay. Excuse me, Truman's given me a little information that we're just not going to be able to make Zoom work, and we're just going to go ahead and continue as is. And some of the people have said, Truman, that they may try to drive into the studio here and just come in and join us at some point, so they might do that. Anyway, so we're going to go ahead. But Sandra, I think kind of what I'm meaning is that there's something missing here that I don't appear to get, which is the concept of the people that, you know, are in corporate power and in political power have access to a lot of the communication and to messaging and to distractions all over. And I wonder how the Supreme Court is going to roll now that we have a doctor who's saying he had a duty to care, and so he's provided abortions because of the law since Roe versus Wade is to provide a woman the medical care that she needs. And these laws are saying, you know, women won't even know that they're pregnant at 6 weeks.
Right.
You know, as soon as a fetal heartbeat happens. And people can have their opinions about what to do, but I don't understand how they think they can direct medical care for everyone else. And so I feel like sometimes our main audience should be the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to think about talking to them. And that's why I'm thinking about there's got to be better and different language between, you know, the political conversation we're having and the feeling, the tremendous feeling that is on both sides of this coin. So, Truman's helping me with my soundboard, and you need to get out of here. Yes, excuse me. Uh-huh. Yes, yes. Yes, yes. I know about that. Truman's making sure I know how to get us out of here and just saying we're going to go. Good luck with your hay. Yeah, he has sorry. Hay delivered, yeah, and he's got to go pick up his hay. And,
yeah,
and
next week we'll try something different.
Yeah. Thank you for trying, Truman. I'm so sorry. And sorry to the other Briefleys. So anyway, now you have my attention. I'm so sorry. I'm kind
of worries.
Splitting my brain in different directions.
It's Vashon. These things happen. And they're good.
Well, we know just enough to be dangerous sometimes. I'm a pretty good social worker. I'm not a bad writer, and I'm a terrible sound engineer. So I couldn't help him at all.
Me? Oh, I certainly can't.
Anyway, if you're hearing what I'm saying, it's that logic is seeming like it's not working. That people who are going to respond to logic may have already responded to logic one way or the other. And there's something deep about beliefs that people dig into and don't want to shift and change. And something about control, that when people are feeling out of control, that they're trying to control other people. I think that's sort of a psychological, you know, kind of an underpinning things that can happen when people are so frightened, is that there's a desperate need to control something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not surprised that all this is bubbling up at this same point in time, you know, with everything unstable.
Yes.
With all of us in free fall, in a tipping point, then I feel like we just need to learn how to talk to each other differently through more poetic use. And so let me ask you the question. So you've just heard me talk about my logic. Mm-hmm. And what I want you to do is, would you read this Burning Bush poem?
Sure.
That you wrote in response to the issues of Roe versus Wade? Explain that a little bit.
Sure. Well, I wrote this poem about my own abortion back before Roe v. Wade was the law. And at the time, I was living in Salt Lake City, Utah, where abortion was considered not only illegal, but by the Mormon Church, murder. I really liked my Mormon neighbors, and I understood that their religion restricted their feelings about abortion. I didn't agree with them, but I honestly can say they're some of the nicest, kindest people I ever met, except we disagreed greatly on that particular subject. But at any rate, my husband and I were a couple of broke hippies, and we were not in any way ready to bring a child into the world. And so I, through great old wonderful Planned Parenthood, they got me an appointment in Los Angeles, where abortion was legal in the state of California at that time. But we had no money to get there, so we hitchhiked there. So this is about that journey. And I certainly hate the idea of any woman having to go through this, or much worse, at that time, get an illegal one. Women died. I mean, this is a real thing. Young women today don't know this. They weren't raised during the pre Roe v. Wade era, but women died, unless you had a lot of money, and then you went to Europe. Oh, okay. Sorry.
No. I'm trying to restrain myself from talking some about the work that I was doing at that time in that field, and so mm-hmm. I'll come back to that. But really, I want to hear how you would write poetry about something so difficult and so painful.
Okay, it's called The Burning Bush. Waking with the dawn, where we pitched our tent just south of Bakersfield, heading north. I'd forgotten how cold the nights are here, how beautiful the sunrise, from where I lay bleeding from a legal abortion granted me in an L.A. clinic, not available in Salt Lake where we lived, and only enough cash for the clinic, none for travel, so we stuck out our thumbs there and back. The getting there was beautiful, passing through the mountains and down onto the valleys, blazing with light and color, and a couple of long rides. The way back was worry, about the bleeding mostly, and the rides were few. One with a couple who asked why we were out on the road, and when I told them, they put us out with a dose of Christian charity, thou shalt not kill. That morning, I woke to the sunrise, stiff, cold, smelled smoke, looked up to see a burning bush, and in the distance, fire, chaparral igniting with matchstick speed, like the second coming. We did not burn in those hellfires, but got a ride out with kinder folk, with kids, water, food. I kept the reason for our travels to myself this time, still glad I'd made my choice.
You know, what strikes me about that is it's so personal. And how can you argue, you know, with personal experience? It's different than arguing at a logical or a belief status. It's not an argument. You know, it's a testimony. It's a confession. It's a personal, sacred memory. You know, a difficult thing that you had to reckon with. You're not asking anything of anybody. You are letting people know how you felt about that and the different ways that people affected you, you know, as part of that journey. So I'm just, you know, getting that for me, when I hear poetry, it's a different thing. It's not a challenge to me and what I think. It's a voice that I respect. You know, we have to respect everyone else's experience, I think. Or we're in an authoritarian world where everybody wants to control everyone else. And maybe that's what's happening. But I like to believe that we can still evolve and that we can still make democracy work and be generally supportive of all beliefs in this country and find common ground of what, you know, can work for most of us. And what I was going to tell you about my background was that I was working for Planned Parenthood at that time. I think I was there from 71 to 73. And during that period of time, New York had a demonstration project going on for 3 years where they were studying the effects of abortion or not abortion. And they did a 3-year project where they were gathering statistics on children, and that children born in unwanted circumstances that they could measure by, you know, the child's growth and development, the child's bonding with the parent, the abuse and neglect that happened in households. They did a before and after study of the abortion laws were put into place that allowed women abortions in New York, and then they gathered these statistics to try to figure out, would it be of great benefit to the state to make this a law? And they did find that there was enormous changes in effects on children when they let women have abortions, that the households had less violence and abuse, the children had less neglect and were growing and developing better who were born. And, you know, they weren't passing on some cycle of abuse that could be measured. And I was very struck with that because it was this combination of logic and let's see. You know, the demonstration project just asked everybody to let's see what this teaches us. And at that point, I think they found that the benefits of allowing and not continuing to fight about the laws of abortion or send women to, you know, illegal back alleys, which is what they would do, because women will control their own reproduction, whether or not it's legal. I mean, really, give us a break. And if men want to get in and help us with all that, we'd love that. But don't leave it to women and then be shocked at what women do to try to have good lives for their family. And I was just very struck with kind of my feeling about kind of what you were saying about that time, because to hear the conversations of women, young women, about their pregnancies, you know, nobody went to abortion happy.
No.
It was never about birth control. It was always about, I'm stuck with this and I'm alone with this. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to be able to be a good mother in these circumstances. And, you know, it was very humbling to me. You know, it's pretty hard to have hardened beliefs when you're hearing people's stories like yours, like your poem.
And mine's a mild one. I mean, this law also says a woman cannot have an abortion, even in the case of rape or incest.
Exactly.
And imagine, I don't know how they haven't imagined a woman carrying a child to term in either one of those circumstances.
It's awful. It's cruel. It's astounding to me. And the other aspect of the law that I find completely unsupportable and crazy is the fact that anyone can sue. There's no harm to these people, and that they're paying the money that they get from the lawsuits go back to the people who asked to sue, and it's like a bounty.
Yeah.
And there have already been two cases in this morning's NPR that I was listening to where somebody just reported some doctor or this doctor for doing an abortion because they wanted that $10,000.
Yeah.
Now, you know, that's just ludicrous.
Yeah.
There's nothing constitutional or even sane about that.
What I'm hoping this will do, at least maybe in the state of Texas, is the people who see this the way you do, the way I do, who understand the gravity of this, will vote, will begin at the down ballot level and begin to change the politics in that state and all other states in this country for some sanity to prevail.
Yeah.
Without that, it takes work. Democracy, I forget who said it, but democracy takes work.
Yeah.
It will die without it.
Yeah.
So if folks vote, if folks get involved politically, if they decide to do that, then things can change. Without that, then, you know.
Well, we'll slide back into what most of the world is ruled under, which is kind of authoritarian, you know, cruel dictatorships. And
I don't think
we want that. Yeah.
That could happen, but I think we proved with this election of the new president, Joe Biden, that people woke up. At least they woke up and voted. They got out of their chairs and off the couch and voted. So that's something.
It's really important. And you know, the grand old party has gotten very good at coming back and deflecting and saying, well, we had almost the same number of people turn out to vote.
Well, then there's a whole nother fake news subject, that whole thing. Yeah.
Well, it's a hard conversation, you know, for everybody. It's not easy, and it's critically important that we realize, you know, there are a lot of battles we're trying to fight and a lot of things that people are trying to show up for, I think. And I get overwhelmed about that sometimes. As a social worker, you know, I've had to show up for millions and millions of issues, and I am buoyed by poetry. I have to go back to something that seems, if not simple, kind of clear and thoughtful and really deep in a spiritual way about seeing what is the natural order of things and how to accept what is, but also speak to the side of growth and you know, sanity and clarity, and not let us just drift in passivity, you know, to something that, but you know, because somebody told me once that Marx never anticipated beer and television. You know, that if we see ourselves as passive consumers of democracy, we're sunk. We are the ones who create a government for ourselves and by ourselves. And I can't remember if it was Ben Franklin or Thomas Jefferson that said that, you know, it's a democracy is great if you can keep it. And I just hope that people will show up. I remember Clarissa Pinkola Estes, who wrote Dancing with the Wolves, Dances with Wolves, you know, an early sort of feminist tome about find the beast and the wild person in you and get out there. And she sent a wonderful email around, I think early on in maybe Bush 2's election, basically saying, think about it this way. You have been born for this time. That those of us on the planet right now are the ones charged with making a decision about whether you'll sit idly by or kind of stand for some of the important principles that have given us a very good life in America. And when I say us, I mean whites, because I think that's not been true for all of our populations. And, you know, people are fleeing to this country to try to come in from the climate or from, you know, brutal political realms. And we're not acting like any kind of beacon of light at this point.
Nope. But there's a lot going on. There sure is.
Well, I just really kind of appreciate a poetic sense. And I'm wondering if there's, I know you bought some other poems, and I'd love to hear some of the other things that you have developed and, you know, kind of your thinking behind it. And
I have one here by a friend of mine who's also a poet on the island. This relates to a NPR story a while back about, I believe it was a story from Iraq, this particular one. And it relates so well to war and the messes we cause when we go about nation building, and that certainly happened there and in Afghanistan. But this is a story about a woman who was charged with taking care of bodies. And the title is The Body Washer, and the name of the poet is Margaret Ronconi. She wears the robe of the last victim she washed. Some are too worn to keep. The bodies have so much in common, limbs missing, heads dismantled, like a video game. Only this war is real, begun after false pretense, continued with greed. She begins with the feet, keeping her eyes from wandering up the body, the ribs raised from the last breath, the breasts of young mothers emptied of milk. Where is the child now? She is gentle with every length of skin, but with the hands takes extra care. How rice was cupped, a son or daughter's head padded with love, a husband or wife's tender hours stroked before the fire's shredded lives. Mm. I just love that poem because it encapsulates so much about what's left behind, you know.
Thank you. That's so beautiful.
And in
our last remaining minute, I want to do what I promised to do, which is give you the website for 100,000 Poets for Change. It's 100tpc.org, and they are having this event on Saturday, September 25th. You can listen to or watch poetry being streamed all over the world by poets trying to influence policy and, you know, express their feelings about things. And there is a curriculum and a set of poetry for children. There's a sign up to read, to commit to read poetry to children with a curriculum on using poetry with children from Florida State University, and a little booklet of poems that are really good to read with people that you can download.
Sounds great.
So 100tpc.org, and the 100 is a number, then tpc.org. Sandra, I want to thank you for coming in. We're out of time.
Thank you so much.
And we'll see y'all next week, Brieflies.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.